Okay. Yeah, thank you, Luis, for the kind introduction. And so I'm very grateful for the invitation to come here to give a seminar, and enjoying the discussions and hospitality very much. So as announced, I'm going to talk about detection of symmetry protected and symmetry enriched topological phases. And actually, during the preparation of the talk, I had to think about an idiom I learned. It's carrying coals to Newcastle. But maybe this is not a bad thing. Anyway, so the work that I'm presenting has been inspired by works from many people here in the audience. So what I'm going to talk about is I start by giving a very brief introduction to topological phases in condensed matter, and then talk about two topics. First, I'm going to talk about how we can detect symmetry-protected topological phases in one-dimensional systems. And particularly what I want to show is that given we have a wave function, how can we extract the characterizing properties from it, like mostly from numerical simulations. And then in the second part, I want to show how we can think of symmetry-enriched topological phases on on cylinders, and then apply very similar techniques, and then extract some characterizing properties of symmetry-enriched topological phases. And the first part has been done in collaboration with Ari Turner, and the second part with Jin-Yu Huang and Chen Chia. So matter usually can occur in different phases, and when I, in this talk now, talk about phases, what I mean is like some sort of an equivalence class. I think two states are in the same phase if they can be adiabatically connected, so we can just find a path connecting the two states without having to close the gap. And usually these phases are understood in terms of symmetry breaking. So prominent example are, for example, a crystal where the translation and rotation symmetry of space are broken, and also magnets where the spin rotation and time reversal symmetry are broken. And these phases are then characterized by local order parameters. So in particular, if we have a problem, we can identify the symmetries, and then we can write down order parameters that help us to distinguish different phases. So if you, for example, would look at a spin model, we can then draw these kind of phase diagrams where we have some ordered phase, where we have a finite magnetization, and we have a disordered phase where the magnetization would be zero. And that helps us, and of course, to do all kinds of measurements and numerical simulations to detect these phases. However, in the past decades, it was discovered that there exist also phases that cannot be detected by local order parameters, phases that cannot be described in terms of symmetry breaking. And probably the most prominent example is the fraction quantum Hall effect. And the fraction quantum Hall effect represents a very exciting or new type of matter with unusual properties. And first of all, and this is what I mentioned already, this kind of matter cannot be characterized by symmetry breaking. But one thing that I find very exciting is that the building blocks for these materials, or like for the effect, is just a two-dimensional electron gas, so something consisting out of electrons with a quantified charge, elementary charge. However, in the quantum Hall state, we have excitations that carry just fractions of an elementary charge and obey so-called fractional statistics, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later on. And one of the characteristic properties of these phases is that the ground state degeneracy depends on the topology of a system. So if we take, for example, a fraction quantum Hall system and put it on a torus, then we would find that the ground state has a particular degeneracy, while the ground state would be unique if you put it on a sphere. And this has then been nicely explained by Shaogan Wen in terms of a topological order. So instead of having conventional order in terms of symmetry breaking, we have now this sort of this name of topological order, which characterizes the fractional quantum Hall states. Good. And for the sake of this talk, or maybe also more general, I want to now distinguish here two different types of topological order. The first type, what I call here, intrinsic topological order. An intrinsic topological order is a is like a intrinsically topologically ordered phase is a phase that cannot be adiabatically connected to a trivial phase by any path. So what we can just do whatever we want. It's impossible to leave this topological phase without having to undergo a phase transition. And examples include the fraction quantum Hall effect that I've shown in the previous slide, and also spin liquids. And there are many other examples for these too. The second class, or like the second type or kind that I want to distinguish from the first one are symmetry protected phases. And these are phases which cannot be transformed adiabatically to a trivial state only by symmetry preserving path. So in the second example, we actually have to play by certain rules. So in principle, if we are very rude people and we just do whatever we would like, we are always able to connect these states to trivial states, but not if we are obeying certain laws. And I want to start now by talking about these the second case, the symmetry protected phases. And I want to start talking about a specific example, which I like to demonstrate a few things on. So, and this is the spin one Heisenberg chain. So in the spin one Heisenberg chain, we just have here the isotropic coupling between neighboring spins in a one-dimensional system. Turns out when we diagonalize this Hamiltonian on a ring, so with periodic boundary conditions, we find that this system has a unique ground state, and then there's a gap to the excitations in the system. And this is something that Haldane figured out a long time ago. And in particular, this state, that or the ground state, does not break any of the symmetries of the Hamiltonian. And I think a nice way to get a picture or like of what kind of phase we have is given by the so-called AKLT model. So the AKLT model is has a Hamiltonian that is adiabatically connected to the Heisenberg model. And the AKLT model presents us or gives us a very nice cartoon picture of what's going on here. So in particular, in this AKLT model, we take the spin ones, like shown up here by these black dots, and we split all up the spin ones into pairs of spin one halves here. And in the ground state of this AKLT model, the spin one halves are forming singlets with the neighboring spins, as shown here. And this gives us, of course, a unique ground state. And the gap to the first excitation would be the energy cost for destroying one of the singlets. Good. But now something interesting is happening if we're looking at the system not on a ring, but just on an open chain. What's happening is illustrated here. We find in this AKLT construction that the first and the last spin one half in a system, they don't have anyone to become friends with, so they don't have anyone to form a singlet with. And these are just decoupled, sitting at the ends or the edges of the chain, and they're yielding a fourfold degeneracy of this ground state. In the original model, namely in the Haldane model, there wouldn't be an exact degeneracy. However, we would find that there's a degeneracy which is exponentially small in the system size. Good. So, and again, something exciting is happening here because we start here from a system which is built of spin ones. So the spin ones are the elementary building blocks. And we find here that there are spin one halves showing up in the spin one halves, spin one halves showing up in a spin one system. And this is not pure fantasy. Actually, this is also observed in certain materials. So if we take materials like this material here, and if we dope it with non-magnetic impurities, what's actually happening is we just kind of cutting open many of these spin one chains. And in magnetization experiments, people then observe the indications of having spin one halves. And the spin one half density then depends on how much we dope it with non-magnetic impurities. Good. So this is one specific example of an SPT, or like a symmetry protected topological phase. And but this concept is much broader, and we can apply it to many, many different systems. And so I just want to tell now a few words about how we can understand this class of phase. So we have now a Hamiltonian and a corresponding ground state, and we assume that the ground state has the same symmetry as the Hamiltonian. So the symmetry group GH is the same as the symmetry group G psi. Now we observe that something which we call like the fractionalization of symmetries occurs. And what we mean by this is the following. So we just take the ground state on a finite segment, and we apply some element of the symmetry group to this segment. And of course, in the bulk of a system, nothing is happening because the state is invariant under this symmetry operation. However, the edges can change. And if we just look basically how the space of these edge excitations is changed, this is done by some operators UL that only act on the left side and some operators UR that act only on the right side. And it turns out that these matrices or these operators U are projective representations of the symmetry. What this means is that these are representations which are defined only modulo a phase. What does it mean? So we have like two, if we just multiply two elements of the group to a third one, turns out the representation multiplied to the representation of the third one times some phase factor. And it turns out that this phase factor, actually, or these phase factors in the projective representation yield then a complete classification of symmetry protected topological phases in one dimensional systems. And this was shown by Chen Chia and also Shougang Wen. And this is so-called second cohomology class. Let me just give you some illustrative example for this. So let me just also repeat what I just said. So we have now projective representations. And one question is, well, we could ask is like, say we have now two different projective representations of the same group. The question is, just by rephasing the operators, can we actually transform one projective representation into another representation? And this question is actually answered by the cohomology class. If they're in the same class, they can be connected adiabatically. If they are in different classes, there's no way that we can just rephase them to go from one to the other one. And let me just demonstrate this now for two different symmetries. In particular, I want now to check. So if maybe someone gives me a Hamiltonian of a particular symmetry and asks me, well, is there a chance that I can find some 1D SBT for this Hamiltonian or not? So let's just first check out a Zn symmetry, which is the symmetry of rotating this star here. And the generator of the group is R. So this does the rotation by 2 pi over n. And there's an identity. If you just take R to the power of n, we get the identity. And then for the projective representation that we can write down, we find that UR to the power of n is equal to some phase factor. But that can be easily undone. We can actually just redefine our projective representation by say we have now another one, which is U tilde R, and this is E to the I phi divided by n times UR. And we see like that U tilde has now no phases. I mean, UR tilde is now just a linear representation. So the result from this is that there are no non-trivial representations of Zn. Okay, so that didn't work out. Let's go to the next example, and that's the class Z2 cross Z2. This is actually the symmetry of a book or a modern smartphone. So we have like two axes about which we can rotate it. So we can rotate it about the x-axis and the z-axis. And for both generators, we can actually do the same thing as here. We can say we can have a phase for rotating it by pi, really. And then we can just get rid of this phase, or basically that fixes the phase for ux and also for uz.
I'm assuming that is symmetry of the.
Well, almost, if you look from the distance.
Okay.
Approximate symmetry. So, but there's a third identity, that is that Rx and Rz commute. So we can have here another phase, maybe like by Ux, Uz is equal to e to the I phi xz times Uz times Ux. But this phase, there's not much we can do about this phase because we already fixed the phases of Ux and Uz. So And since this is an order two group, there are like two choices. It can be either zero or pi. So turns out, like, if we have a system that has a Z2 cross Z2 symmetry, there are actually two inequivalent phases. So we can have either a kind of linear representation or like one projective representation in which UX and UZ anti-commute. Good. And from this, we now see how we can label different SPTs for a given symmetry. And if we now have a system of someone that gives us a state, this is what we are interested in. So we want to have information about these projective representations. And this is what I want to talk about now. This is like what the main part of the detection is, that we, if we have a state, how can we get information about the projective representations? And that's maybe not clear, but there's a very useful tool, and this is the Schmidt decomposition, which can help us to give, yes?
Sorry, can I just ask a bit of previous slide and quick clarification? When you say that phases phi equals zero and pi cannot be gauged away, what is it that decides how you relate? So on the first one, when you, on the Zn one, when you gauge away that phase, I guess I just don't appreciate the difference. Why is it that on the first one we can perform a transformation which removes the phase, and on the second one we can't?
Oh, I mean, if I just write down some phase, so here, like, no matter what the phases are that I put in front of the like whatever kind of phase I choose here for the e to the i phi,
yeah,
I can just remove by this one here.
Yes. Yeah.
And for the second one, I have like a bunch of phases. I mean, I have a phase for rx squared. I have a phase for rz squared,
okay,
and so on. I can just fix two of them, but the third one, I cannot do this consistently. I cannot get rid of this phase factor. And that's, I'm stuck with. I mean, there's no way that I can just rephase single operators and get rid of it.
Okay, I get that.
Okay, so yeah. These matrices U are the projective representation now contain the information that we want to access in order to kind of put labels on different phases. And now I want to talk about, given a state, how can we actually just extract this information from a state? And for this, there will be the Schmidt decomposition will be a very useful tool. And let me just briefly reiterate this slide. So we have a system, and for I think all the examples that we look at, we actually can think of like an infinite chain. We have like an infinitely long system, and we just cut it in the middle into two kind of half infinite chains. And this data, and then we say like the left part is A and the right part is B. And in the Schmidt decomposition, we just take our wave function and we just decompose it into a superposition of product states with respect to the two bipartitions. And this Schmidt decomposition then gives us direct access to the edge modes in the following way. So we have like an infinite system that doesn't have any edges, like this one here. And when we do a Schmidt decomposition here, and then the Schmidt states actually have here some artificial edges, and we are going to use these artificial edges now to study a system. So, and the next few slides, I'm going to show quite a few details on how we can extract these projective representations. And yes.
Can you go back and tell us, is there anything hidden under the assumption that this chain is infinite and that you don't specify the boundaries? You know, you are talking about the symmetry. You want to tell us how the symmetry acts on the system.
Yes.
Are you not going to tell us how it acts on the boundaries?
Well, the thing is that I could also explain this in terms of a finite system where we just cut out basically a segment, but then we have two edges. And I think conceptually it's the same, but then we would have to distinguish like whatever acts here and whatever acts here on these parts. But by having an infinite system, I only have to deal with one edge. So that is conceptually easier.
The edge where you cut the system into two.
Yes. And in fact, but if I just do this numerically, I could also say that, well, I just look at a at a long chain, like a long finite chain, assume that this is like very long compared to the correlation length. And then I have to do one trick actually. Because if I do the, if I say that I just do numerically exact diagonalization, I find the ground state, but then there will be a problem that the edge modes will actually couple somehow. And I would not, if I for example, do a exact diagonalization study on a finite model, then I have a coupling of these chains, and this will is something that I don't want because I have then, I think locally, some superposition of two of these states. And then in order to do this, I mean, this is no problem, but then you would have to add maybe a field at the boundaries that fixes this problem.
So is that how we should try to think about this infinite chain, that there are some fields?
Well, what's happening...
There's no correlation between the edges?
Between, no, I mean, I think the way I like to think it, and this is like also how I would, I think, do this for the matrix product state on the next slide, that it doesn't matter what happens very, very far away from the cut that I'm looking at.
Provided that there is no correlation between...
Exactly, yeah.
That's the assumption.
Yeah. Good. Okay, so the main part is that we want now to... we can basically learn it from the Schmidt decomposition, but I want to show this, a few details now, how we can extract this information directly from the matrix product states. And that will be then, I think, particularly useful for those who do simulations using DMIG or any kind of matrix product state related method. And this is something which you heard also yesterday in Martin's talk already, about that matrix product states present a very efficient way of representing one-dimensional quantum states. And I'm going to heavily use this kind of diagrammatic representation of matrix product states, which probably most of you have seen at some point. And what we do here, we just express the coefficients in the many-body wave function as a product of these matrices. And here, usually if we write down a matrix product state, we just have matrices, say, B here. Here we have a form, actually as proposed by Giffre, that we split up the matrices in a product of some matrices that relate actually the local basis and the Schmidt basis, and the matrices lambda here are just diagonal matrix containing the Schmidt values. So this is just at this point just a choice to express it like this. And here we have now the sort of local indices. This is just a physical index. And in the case of our spin one chain, this would be just d equals to 3. And here we have the bond index contracted along the horizontal direction, which is chi. So for the AKT chain, for example, this would just be 2. And I write here that So when I write down a matrix product state, I actually have many different ways to do this. I have quite some degrees of freedom to choose my matrices. But here I choose the matrices in the so-called canonical form. And the canonical form is, in a canonical form, we choose the matrices such that if we have a matrix product state and we just write down everything on the left of this cut here, then the index here, like the index that's sticking out on the left, is actually just enumerating the different Schmidt states. So this canonical form of a matrix product state gives us a direct access to the Schmidt states for a bipartition at any cut. Right? So I can just, if I just want to have the Schmidt decomposition here, I find these lambdas are the Schmidt coefficients, and everything contracted from here to the right is the right Schmidt state, and everything contracted from here to the left is the left Schmidt state. Good. So far, we talked a lot about symmetries. So now the question is, like, given we have a state that is symmetric with respect to a particular symmetry operation, how does the matrix, or how do the matrices and the matrix product state transform under these symmetries? And what we want, so if we have now a state and we act on the state with a symmetry operation, the state itself should remain invariant. It should not change. So. And the way I can just represent it is in this form. So I have now the matrix product state. Here are the physical indices. And now, in this case, I just apply a symmetry operator to each of these physical legs. Just to think about some concrete example, this symmetry operation could just be a pi rotation of the spins. And I want that this state is actually not changed from this spin. So if I multiply all the transferred matrices together, I want to have the same physical state back. And in order for this to be the case and for the state to remain in this canonical form that I want, this is a way to go. So we just find that there's some overall phase vector, and we actually have here some unitaries attached to the left and to the right. And we see if we have now this transformed matrices and we just multiply them together, they give exactly the same physical state as before, because the unitaries just cancel each other. And I would get the same picture, not talking about matrix product state, but just say, let me just look how the Schmidt states transform under symmetry operations. So if I just basically say, okay, I take my Schmidt state, I take my symmetry operations, and now I just construct a representation of the symmetry with respect to the Schmidt states. This is exactly the same. Good. And what I demonstrated here in slightly more detail for local symmetries or symmetries that just act on each bond individually, we can derive the same result for time reversal, where we just replace the matrices gamma by its complex conjugate, and inversion, like inversion if you just flip a lattice around the bond inversion, and there we replace the matrices gamma by its transpose. Good. So now we see how matrices transform under symmetry operations. But now we come to what I promised earlier, namely that we can now directly obtain all the matrices U. And there's a very convenient way to do this if, again, we have access to the matrices forming our state. And let me first state how you get it, and then I explain why this works. So all we have to do is we just take the matrices that we obtain from our numerical simulation, like here, and we construct which I call the generalized transfer matrix, or the mixed transfer matrix. So I just sandwich the symmetry operation in between two of the matrices. And now all I have to do is to just find the dominant eigenvector of this matrix. So we know already, since it's a symmetry operation, that the dominant eigenvalue has to be 1. And the corresponding eigenvector is then already the matrix U that we are interested in. And using this diagrammatic representation of matrix product state, we can actually nicely see how this works. So let's do the following. Let's just calculate the overlap of a transformed Schmidt state, so this is the one at the top, with one that's not transformed at the bottom.
Sorry, what's the meaning of the tilde?
What?
Why do you have tilde on top of gamma here?
Well, this is a transformed.
But the transformation you
have. Oh, but it can also, I mean, yeah, so there are local transformation, like which I can express in terms of a sigma, but it can also have some transformation of the tensors, like some complex conjugation. For example, if we look at time reversal symmetry for spins, it will actually be that gamma goes to e to the I pi sy times gamma.
Okay, so you're saying the transform gamma is gamma mm-hmm. with the tilde and sigma.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. The
transformation is given by the sigma and the tilde.
Yeah, so we have, so I think that probably covers it all then. That's why there's a gamma here. Thanks. Good. So now we just calculate this overlap of the transformed Schmidt states and the not transformed Schmidt state of this form. But now we can actually use this, because before we figured out how matrix product states of symmetric states transform under symmetry operations, we can just plug it in. And we see that basically all the U matrices just go away, except the one on the left stays. Plus we have like some overall phase here. But now we can use another nice property, because we know as the state is in the canonical form, we know that T, like the transfer matrix, has a dominant eigenvector, and that's the identity. So basically, if we just multiply all of them together, all which is left is the identity. Oopsie, sorry. And then we can just replace all this by just the identity, which is a dominant eigenvector, and we can just replace everything here by the dominant eigenvector of the generalized or mixed transfer matrix, and then we exactly find that the generalized the dominant eigenvector of the generalized transfer matrix is exactly this transformation U sigma that we are interested in. So it's then very easy to calculate if you're doing DMRG, et cetera. Good. After all these technicalities, I want to show actually that it works. So let us look at a specific example. It is the spin one Heisenberg model that we've seen already before, but now I added another term, which is single ion anisotropy. And this single ion anisotropy, this indicates if D is going to infinity, is just a simple product state. It's a state where all spins are in the SV equals to zero eigenstate. And in this phase, Z2 cross Z2 can stabilize an SPT phase. I mean, this is just the symmetry of this Hamiltonian. And we define now some sort of order parameter. And this is zero if the symmetry is broken. And this we can detect, again, easily if we do matrix product state simulations and we diagonalize the generalized transfer matrix, then we're going to find that the dominant eigen the largest eigenvalue of this matrix is smaller than one. So then we just say that's zero. And if this is one, then we just set this quantity to the commutator of ux and uz. And we know already, I demonstrated this example for z2 cross z2, and we found that there are two different kind of representations, either ux and uz commute or they anti-commute. So this is what we get. So we just use numerical methods like ITBD or IDMRG to get these matrices gamma and lambda. Then we just plug them in, diagonalize the transfer matrices, and we get the matrices UX and UZ, calculate this commutator and plot it here. So we see the Haldane phase, this quantity is always minus one, and in the large D phase, where we have just a simple product state, this is one. So and this is what we can do basically for every SPT phase that we are interested in.
Sorry, can you repeat how you compute this? Given an MPS,
mm-hmm.
you first determine how many. What do you determine first?
Not much. I mean, I can just. So I do DMRG. We just do a flow diagram. So we do IDMRG, and from this we get some. Set, let's say we have just a unit cell of one, so we just have get gamma and lambda, and now we just say we are interested in the Z2 cross Z2 symmetry. So then we have now Rx, which would be like e to the I pi Sx, and the same for say S, right?
So that's how the symmetry acts on the
physical index, yeah. So And now I just do exactly what I just showed before. Now I just take the matrices gamma gamma lambda and plug in here the Rx and Rz and diagonalize this matrix. And well, I don't even have to diagonalize, I just find the dominant eigenvector.
So you find two matrices?
Yes.
Okay.
So I find basically I can just plug it in here, then I find that UXZ is equal to some phase something of order one times. And this is then the dominant eigenvector.
Sure.
And then I just calculate the commutator shown on the. And this is already the result.
But you wrote zero directly if the symmetry was broken.
Well, this is like if I just diagonalize it, and so say I have like actually eta times
yeah.
this, and if I see that eta is up to maybe 10 to the minus 10 equals to 1, then I say, okay, we are in a symmetric phase. If it is actually 0.8, then I know that the symmetry is broken.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you replaced it with a zero there, but you have a way of assessing.
In fact, the way I did this plot, I just plot here eta to the power of 10 times the commutator, and then this is the plot I got.
I see. So you don't have to do anything by hand.
No. It's all coming out of. I mean, this plot is directly taken from the result of my numerics. And well, I've chosen the spots wisely here because if I just take a dot which is like directly at the transition, then I might just get some zero where it's not zero yet. Okay.
What's
good.
What's the story about the minus one going to plus one? Like why those two other different classes?
Wait, I mean, minus one or plus one tells us if UX and UZ either commute or if they anti-commute. This is the commutator here.
Oh, it's just called symmetric.
Yeah, I mean, like this. But if we have UX times UZ is equal to plus or minus. Can you see it? UZ times UX, and this is just the commutator. Good. So that works, I think, very well if you're having these, if you're using DMRG, et cetera. However, maybe if you choose not to do so, there are also ways that we can detect SVTs. Since I want to have some time to talk about SVTs, I'm not going to explain this in detail, but I'm very happy to explain this in private discussions in more detail.
But is this second approach superseded by the first one?
Well, if you can do DMRG, or you're willing to do DMRG, this is, I think, much, much simpler. What I'm telling now is possible, I think, basically using any method which allows you to calculate correlation functions, but it will be more complicated and more involved. It's not as straightforward because here we can do the same idea for every symmetry. Here we actually have to do slightly different ideas, use different ideas for different symmetries. And one actually was already introduced a long time ago, namely the string order. And in fact, using knowledge of whether matrices are, say, commuting or anti-commuting, we actually can explain why this string order works. And in particular, the surprising thing is here that that we get, based on these on the projective representations, we obtain selection rules that tell us that the string order has to be zero, and it doesn't have to be zero in other phases. So we can just calculate the string order parameter if we have, for example, the Z2 cross Z2 symmetry. But we can just write down now slightly more exotic and interesting looking order parameters for other symmetry. The one I like is, for example, for inversion symmetry. So inversion symmetry can also stabilize SVT phases. And in fact, if we use the first approach here, it's easy to then we can actually distinguish the two phases by checking if gamma times gamma star is equal to plus or minus identity. But if we don't have access to the matrices, we can just calculate the expectation value of an operator that actually does twist the subsystem, like indicated here. We just take a part of a system, just rotate it, or just invert it, and then we calculate this expectation value. And in fact, if you just rewrite this in terms of matrix product state, you can simply prove that this expectation value actually calculates the trace of this quantity here. And here I show that this actually works. So I just calculate this expectation value, again, for the same phase diagram as before. And then we see that in the Haldane phase, it goes to minus one, it goes to plus one in the trivial phase. Good. And here, again, it would go to zero if the state is not symmetric under this operation. Good. So this concludes the part on SVTs. And I hope that I could show you that if you do DMRG or matrix product state methods, we more or less can just read off the projective representations. But there are also straightforward ideas how we can just calculate it in Monte Carlo or maybe in some exotic experiments. Good. Let me now come to the second part, which is on symmetry and rich topological phases. And I want to first use two slides where I want to explain what we mean by symmetry and rich topological phases. In the very beginning of the talk, I already said a few words about intrinsic topological order. And I also mentioned that intrinsic topological order does not require any symmetry. And the characterizing property of topological order are the so-called anionic excitations. So at least we can get a partial justification of topological order by just basically looking what kind of, so if we have at least this is how I see it, that someone gives me a state and I can just look what kind of anionic excitations does this state support, and then I can have an idea what kind of topological order we have. Good. But it turns out if we have certain symmetry requirements, we say that, well, we have topological order, but also we want the system to have a particular symmetry, that then it's a somewhat richer structure evolved. So in particular, before, without symmetry, we only had here big blue blob, and now it turns out there's also a green one. So we have now like a more complex structure in the presence of symmetries. So the question is, like, how can we understand these phases? And let me just show you some cartoon pictures, which will also draw the similarities to the 1D SPT in this case. So let us assume that we have a topologically ordered state, and there's a cartoon picture here showed us the superposition of loops that's shown here. And again, we have now a particular symmetry in the Hamiltonian, and we assume that the symmetry group of the Hamiltonian is the same as the symmetry of the state. And now what we are talking about is that we can have, again, a fractionalization of the symmetry operation as in the 1D SPT. However, we have now a fractionalization in terms of the anions. So the idea, as shown here, is that we just create a pair of two anions, then the anions transform under projective representations, as shown here. So, and again, for this kind of type of, or for this class of SET states, we can then again use the second cohomology to distinguish different SET phases. So the idea would be here, we have now two states having the same kind of topological order. We have the same types of anions. However, the anions transform differently under symmetry operation. Good. But now we're just having a small problem, because initially, like when we talked about SPT, showed that, well, simply by just doing a Schmidt decomposition, we actually get access to our fractionalized edge states. But here for topological order states, that will be a little bit more involved. And for this, I have to explain one extra bit, and then it turns out we can actually use a very similar method. Good. So this is also something that I mentioned at the very beginning of my talk, that topologically ordered systems are characterized by a topological degeneracy. So in particular, for a given system, we find a number of, like if you put a system on a torus, we find that the number of degenerate states is equal to the number of different kind of quasi-particle types we have in a theory. So if you have a system with four quasi-particles, we would find that the degeneracy on the torus is four. Good. And so now we have a ground space, say, of our four states. And in particular, we can just take any superposition of those states, or like any basis for these states, and all of them would be valid ground states, apparently. But we want now to choose a particular basis. So what we do, we just use, again, a Schmidt decomposition as before, or we just form a bipartition of our torus in this way, that we just have a bipartition into two cylinders. So there's a non-trivial bipartition of the torus. And now we choose the basis in which we represent our ground state such that the entanglement of the left and the right part here is minimized. And it has been shown by a number of nice works that if we choose this basis to represent our ground states, the ground states are also eigenstates of a Wilson loop operator that actually wraps parallel to the cut. In other words, if we then do as we showed before, where I said, like, well, we just think of the Schmidt decomposition as being a virtual cut, we actually see here that at the edges of our cut, we would actually see that there would be a localized anion of type A here. So now the Schmidt decomposition of these minimally entangled states gives us direct access to the anion. And now we can go actually a similar route as we did before, but with like one extra step. Instead of thinking of a torus, where we would actually immediately have two edges to deal with, we want, again, as I showed here, we want to isolate the two things. So we just look now at an infinite cylinder on which we can also just get the topologically degenerate states and then do a Schmidt decomposition of this infinite cylinder. And the example that we want to look at now is the is a Z2 liquid. And just for me, it's simplest to just think in terms of the toric code model as a specific example. This toric code model, we have four different types of anions, which are illustrated here. So we have like an identity, which means like there's nothing, the vacuum. There's an electric charge, and the electric charge corresponds to a defect on a vertex here. And we have magnetic charges that correspond to like sort of a pi flux through a plaquette. And we have bound pairs of electric and magnetic particles, which are called a fermion, because actually they, as you can show, obey fermionic exchange statistics. Good. And then we can use it to a technical step. We can now say that, well, for the two examples that I'm going to show, we actually have, we can just express the state exactly in terms of a tensor network. And then to just bring it really close to what we looked at before, we can then basically just contract the tensor network just by contracting these rings, and then we have a matrix product state as before. The thing is just that the bond dimension here will be exponentially large with the circumference of a cylinder, but for a system that we look, this is still manageable. Good. Let's now look at two examples. The first one is more like a toy example, which we use to illustrate how things work. And for this, let us assume that we have a system of spin one bosons that live on a square lattice, that's shown here. So on every side, we have a spin one boson. And now those bosons are not conserved, so they can just show up and go away. But whenever there are bosons, spin one bosons on the sides, they want to form AKLT chains. So we have again, like if they're bosons, they split up into spin one halves and then forming the singlet between the different spin one halves. So, and the state that we're looking at is then just an equivalent superposition of all those AKLT chains. If you look from the distance, it will look exactly like the ground state of a toric code model. But only if you look closer, you see that these are actually AKLT chains. But there's one thing that's different, because now if we actually create excitation, if we create electric charge excitations, maybe we just create here vertices where there's just like a line or a string terminating, we actually, this comes automatically with a spin one half. So there's also, while everything is in linear representation, the ends of our chains are in projective representations as before. So, and we can now, this kind of state, like this toy state, we can actually just write down as a very simple tensor product state and do the calculation conveniently. So we just do the same trick as shown before here for the matrix product states. So we just write down the state on a large cylinder, choose a minimally entangled state so that you make sure that there's just an anion of a particular type at this end, and we diagonalize the transfer matrices, which are now considerably larger. Yes?
Sorry, can you explain what you mean by drawing a cylinder here? Why did you draw a cylinder? Is that a statement about the state that you're looking at?
Yeah, I mean, I just take the, I just take my tensor product states on a cylinder.
But the tensor product state has bond dimension 3.
The tensor product state has a bond dimension 3. So here we have chi equals to 3.
Okay, okay. But not the MPS, if you...
Oh, the MPS, as I said, is exponentially large. That's what I'm saying is, In principle, this is like bad, because we don't like things to grow exponentially fast. But here, for the systems, because the correlation...
How do you enforce that this tensor product state would result in the Waldeck flux inside the cylinder?
Oh, this is something that we can do by fixing the boundary. I mean, the way that we obtain this, we actually using the power method. We just reapply the transfer matrix again and again, and then we can actually choose the flux by just choosing the right boundary.
Would give you the degeneracy, but you choose one of the...
Exactly. We just choose a state with a well-defined flux at the end, and that makes sure that we're finding a minimally entangled state. Yeah.
when you break strings or loops in this loop gas condenser,
uh-huh.
you get one type of particles.
Yes.
Right? How would you get the other one?
Oh, the other ones, I mean, there's the so-called flux defect is if we would actually have, I mean, we can just think of, well, actually this we can understand, like we don't need this loop gas of AKT, this we can just think in terms of the toric code model. We can just say that if you have the toric code model, you can have like defective vertices, but can you also defective plaquettes. You have a plaquette, and if the plaquette is flipped, then it just comes with the wrong sign.
Yeah, I'm wondering how this translates to these AKLT chains. I mean, do you have something like, in this picture, like a dual AKLT chain, which you can then break apart and get those flux charges? Or?
No, I mean, the way that I would see that would be, again, I mean, you have the superposition of these AKLT chains. If you just forget about the spin 1/2 defect, it's exactly the same as the toric code model. And then flux defect would just be a change of the sign in the wave function.
I think he was asking maybe like are the n particles in a projective representation in this like wave function?
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's for the practical purpose. If I want to obtain the different sectors, we need to insert a flux. And the way that we do this is that. So when I draw this picture here, or actually let's draw it in here, we can add like some operator here, which we can use to insert a flux into the system. And then basically by having two things, like the one thing is we can choose the flux in this direction, like the kind of the electric flux just by this one, and we can choose a magnetic flux by inserting an operator here. Okay, so yeah, from this then we find that the vacuum and also the magnetic particle they are in a linear representation, and the electric particle and the fermion are in a projective representation. Okay, and we just apply now the same idea to a more physical state, which is the singlet covering of the Kakomi lattice, so it's like the RVB state, and again we find that in this RVB state. The spinon excitations carry a spin 1/2, right? So it's just a similar idea. And again, we can express this RVP state in terms of a simple, or like a tensor product state with a relatively small bond dimension. And we can use the same idea. Also, we can use the same idea to insert fluxes into the system. And we can then obtain the commutator here for the different quasi-particles. And we find that the numbers we get are identical to what we find for this other toy state, suggesting that the two states are then in the same phase. Okay. Yeah, and that basically concludes the part on how we can get it if we have like tensor product states, or like if we... this same idea can also be used with exact diagonalization, so we can... like once we have like access to the full wave function, we can just get the projective representations this way. But analogously to the kind of order parameters, we said yes.
Before you go to that, so if even they use MPS techniques, so if you write this as an MPS,
mm-hmm.
then is it fair to say that you could just look at the Born index? So you could look at the entanglement spectrum again.
Yes.
And for the as you go representations, at least you would see whether so if you had an SU2 symmetry,
mm-hmm.
you look at whether the Born index,
yes.
the cat has integers, semi-integer,
right? Yes, right.
And
yes, yes, yes.
The same
yes.
conclusion there.
Yes, yes.
But your method is completely general. That's
yes, that's right. Yeah.
For arbitrary symmetry groups.
Yeah, I mean you can just do a. Except you don't. Well, in principle, you wouldn't have to think much. You just do your DMRD. You don't have to understand the spectrum. You don't have to conserve symmetries in your code. Exact. You just.
You just need to know that. You're using the right
the flux. In this case, yeah, like we have to think more in the SET case, in the SPT case. In the SET case, we actually have to make sure that we tune into the right flux vector, that we just actually get the right anions that we want to look at. And oh yeah, and also here, what I've shown here, like for this local symmetry, also works for time reversal symmetry, or etc. Like just the same way.
But how did you go from SG2 symmetry to UX UZ? You broke a continuous.
No, I don't need to break it. I just.
No, I know, but you reduced. So you knew that you could extract from by looking at E, M, or F minus one or one,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a commutator or an anti-commutator,
mm-hmm.
you conclude something about the representations of SG2.
Well, here I just conclude something about topological phase with respect to the Z2 cross Z2 symmetry,
right.
which is present. This is like a subgroup of SU2.
Oh,
I'm not sure what exactly we're going to say about SU2. Maybe there could be more. I'm not one of the two now.
But you just
looked
at
Z2. Yeah, right now we're just looking at as this subgroup, and this what we see could also not be destroyed, even if we destroy SU2, if we break SU2 down to Z2 cross Z2. Maybe there's, I'm not 100% positive of this. Anything else that could happen if you have the full SU2 symmetry.
So if this SU2 is rotation, spin rotation,
uh-huh.
you're saying maybe you conserve SZ plus inversion symmetry, and I mean, plus, if you just look at SZ component
mm-hmm.
of SU2, so it's a U1
group. Yes.
This U1 plus maybe half filling being a half filling is enough.
It could, I mean, there's like huge amount of different phases that we can have by combining symmetries, but there are other people in the audience.
I'm just
that
trying
have
to understand what Z2 times Z2 could mean physically. The Z2 times Z2 included in
SG2. Oh, the physically the symmetry is just the spin rotation by pi about two orthogonal axes. This is. So I mean, this would also remain if we add a single ion anisotropy to the system, for example. Okay, and yeah, and similarly to what I've shown for SPT phases, we can also introduce some sort of string order parameter here that we can calculate. So, for example, we can just take our cylinder, and now we just transform a region of the cylinder and calculate the expectation value of this, or the overlap. And this, again, helps us then to detect the different phases. So here we just calculate this quantity in the different sectors, and for this expectation value that is shown here, we know that this string order has a selection rule which tells us it has to be zero if the quasar particle is in a projective representation. It can be finite if we have like a linear representation, and here we can just distinguish the different quasar particles by this expectation value. One thing to notice that this quantity, even though it looks very nice here, it still goes to goes exponentially to zero with the circumference of the cylinder. So though in this MPS, here we still use the tensor product state representation, which are exact, so we can just get very nice plots. But if one would use Monte Carlo, et cetera, with an error bar, it might just be more difficult. Good. So this brings me to the conclusion. So I first talked about some non-local order parameters that we can use to detect symmetry-protected topological phases in one-dimensional systems. First, I showed an idea that we can directly extract all the necessary information by just diagonalizing a generalized transfer matrix in case we have access to the matrix product state. And more generally, we can also just write down some expressions that we can evaluate using various methods that detect these kind of phases. And then the second part, I talked about like symmetry-enriched topological phases and showed that here we can use, at least for a certain class of SET phases, we can use a very similar method to detect the projective representation of different types of anions. And I want to thank you for your attention and also my collaborators on these different works. Thank you.
SU2 versus
Z2. So SU2
is non-abelian, right? So
mm-hmm.
how does, either does this break down if the symmetry is non-abelian, or does it work with this?
Well, with SU2 it works with the, actually I mean, I'm not one of us here what kind of different phase, I mean, there are other experts that know all the symmetries. I'm not so sure about these continuous symmetries. There could be that there's some extra structure, but I'm not sure. I mean, here I'm just showing that we can use Z2 cross Z2, which is a subgroup of SU2, to actually distinguish these phases.
No, but I mean, like, in your Schmidt formalism, like, how do you see generalizing to SU2?
I mean,
would you just have multiplet structures and candidates between?
Well, we do get having the symmetries, we definitely get multiplet structures in the entanglement spectrum. That's for sure. I mean, then we can, and this is what Driffer, I think, pointed out, that if you understand the entanglement spectrum, you can actually see that the bond index corresponds, say, to half integer representation of a spin. So then you can read it off of the entanglement spectrum.
But that's still the Z2 plus, that's the same as the Z2 plus Z2, right?
I don't know if it's the same. This is like, I mean, if you have a Z2 cross Z2 symmetry, you don't necessarily have this kind of multiplet structure.
Right, but then the SU2s, which are half integers, breaks up into doublets, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we still get degeneracy, but not the same ones as in an SU2.
I guess, but you're saying you don't know what happens in general plus. Other things could happen.
I wouldn't exclude it at this moment.
But I think your approach works for continuous group as well, right? You just put some continuous transformation, you get some, you depend on some continuous parameter.
Yes, and that approach should work, yeah, but I don't know if this would, I mean, maybe there's some loopholes, I don't know. I'm extremely sure that it works for discrete symmetries and probably also for continuous, but I'm not 100% sure.
So I would like to know your opinion on this. So sometimes we have an intrinsic topological order. It's not protected by a symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking about chiral semiotics.
I did not mention them here, yeah.
Okay.
I did not mention chirality, no, yeah.
Right. But what we find is that the Hamiltonian does not have, say, S into symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
But the entanglement spectrum is organized according to representation of SU2. So SU2 appears as an emergent symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very different from what you are discussing, right? It's
yes.
Not that SU2 is enforced to protect the symmetry,
mm-hmm.
but to protect the phase. It's not enforced. It's not at the level of Hamiltonian. It's an emergent symmetry that is part of the...
No, I mean here...
That it's part of the intrinsic topological order.
Yeah, I mean, like, all we need... This is like us on the level of a state. We have a state, and we just study the properties of a state. I mean,
but I'm talking about the state that there is no physical SU2. In the physical indices, you don't have SU2 acting as a symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, the entanglement spectrum
would show. I mean, but then it would also. I mean, think whatever shows in the entanglement spectrum would also show on this approach.
I agree with you. That's why I'm mentioning
yeah.
this, right? So mm-hmm. we've been looking at cases where the entanglement spectrum shows more symmetry than the physical magnetic
mm-hmm.
field.
Yeah,
and this symmetry is precisely SU2, and it ends up implying that some of the anions come with spin 1/2 representations.
Yes,
even though SU2 is not part.
It's not a part
of the symmetry,
symmetry yeah.
of the Hamiltonian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would, I think, equally.
So I think this formalism you can still apply.
Would still
that.
Work, yeah. I mean, because this, I think, yeah, would just only look at the symmetry of the anions in this case.
But by passing and looking at how to implement the symmetry at the level of Hamiltonian.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just saying that the entanglement spectrum will reveal this information, even if you don't have the ability to transform the physical degrees of freedom according to UX or UZ.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see.
So there seems to be a part of what you're explaining that is independent of the other part.
Mm-hmm. You think I would have to think more about it.
Right.
Maybe I missed something. I'm not sure if I'm convinced that you have shown that different S and T phases, for example, based on a color code. Because to me, what you have shown are just the kind of symmetry fractionalization
yes.
of the toroidal particles, for
yes.
the particles. But this fractionalization has nothing to do with what kind of global symmetry you would like to impose on the system. It's something intrinsic to the topological order itself. It is completely determined by the identity element of whatever global
mm-hmm.
rule you would like to impose on the system. But identity is just identity. It's the same to all kinds of groups.
Mm-hmm.
And this can be completely, I mean, this kind of symmetry fractionalization can be completely determined by the bare phase. By bare phase, I mean the topological phase before you impose the symmetry.
Is that so? I mean, that would be the case in the example I was mentioning. But are you saying that that's generic?
Yes. I mean, all possible fractionalization for the particles in a topological order.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all kinds of allowed nonce is a
are determined by the.
But can you just parallel are maybe determined from the start, but what he's saying is he can detect which of the which realization you have. Right? So so you have some intrinsic topological order. And then you're saying if you select some symmetry group, global symmetry, then this can be realized in maybe three different options.
Yeah,
he's,
yeah,
he's saying that he's going
to
be able to detect which options.
I mean, all kinds of possible fractionalizations, like how possible order that would allow, can be realized in any symmetry. So it doesn't matter which symmetry you, you can impose on the system. It's all possible fractionalization can be realized.
Okay.
This is the property of the identity element, so that has nothing to do with the symmetry itself.
All right, no further questions or comments?
Let's thank Frankie.